So much, Brian. It's hard to imagine with such beautiful, calming music that the sky is falling. But it is. The sky is falling. The earth is being destroyed. There are changes, changes in the ministry at my congregation. Someone heard a loud noise, and it's really, really upsetting. Run, run for your lives. In this treacherous and frightening world that we live in, there is no shortage of things to be upset about, as Michelle said. Fear and anxiety are spread faster than rabbits. They are viral. Just thinking about our troubles over and over and over again raises our heart rates, sends us into fight or flee mode. When our very survival is at stake, our brains know just what to do. We are built for this. A highly anxious mind, triggered, will skip right over the think it through, ask questions, and listen to the possible answers mode, and run right into the ocean of the certainty of the terribleness of all we fear. We are doomed, I say. We are doomed. It's right there happening in our brain. And it happened to me several times this week alone. Anxiety about house selling and buying drama is my current source of anxious spinning, but next week it'll be something different. The results will be the same. Spinning deeper into my anxiety and fear will always result in less clear thinking and less understanding of the circumstances around me. That spin, that worry, run, hide, freeze, or flee, fight like your life depends on it. All those feelings that anxiety elicits are uncomfortable for a reason. Sometimes there really is a fire or a crisis that demands our full alert response. It really is a matter of life and death, and that anxious response is appropriate and life-saving. But more often these days, we are held prisoner by a constant heightened anxiety that is uncomfortable and, worse, damaging to our relationships and our own fulfillment and happiness. I found some useful advice about handling our anxiety in the study of family systems that I think might be good for all of us as we embark on this co-ministry experiment. And just generally in handling life's complexities as they drop like bombs from the tree we're sitting under. Family systems theory and its close cousin congregational systems theory refers to the family as a self-regulating system. Instead of treating an individual in this modality, what we do, the individual might appear to have this specific problem. In family systems, you have to treat the entire family or the entire congregation, because no problem exists outside the context in which the problem manifests. Everything is related rather than separate and isolated. Murray Bowen specifically referred to the family as an emotional system, as an interlocking, interconnected web of emotional relationships. When I imagine the real organizing force of this congregation, or my family, or any group that works together, I think of it as that emotional system of interconnected relationships. No organizational chart can describe it adequately. This emotional chart is far more powerful and impactful than any org chart could capture. And it's true, it is the true picture of who we really are together. If this is true, then tending to our connections and feelings towards one another is the best way to strengthen a congregation. It's not to say that we're here to assure one another's happiness or salvation. The only person that can truly save us is ourselves. But together, we have a power that we do not have alone. Reverend Doug Taylor reminds us that in this system, each of us is responsible for our own happiness. It's not that I don't care about your happiness. I want to see all of us happy, but I can't make anyone happy. Just like I can't save anyone or enlighten anyone or make anyone realize their full potential or any other grand goal of a meaningful and good life. All I can do is help. But I can't do it for you. No one can. Ultimately, we each have to breathe our own air, write our own stories, break open our own hearts, fall into our own love, and find our own happiness. So this is a healthy and balanced sense of both independence and responsibility to one another. We're not totally disconnected and not totally fused into one unified thinking thing either. There's a connection between Murray Bowen describes when he says, when all else fails, don't just do something, stand there. Should I say that again? When all else fails, don't just do something, stand there. So what he means is that your actual physical presence is the best resource you have to offer in any community or family. It's your integrity as a human being that is your greatest asset. Showing up makes a difference. Edwin Freeman wrote a lovely little fable to illustrate that sort of centering force of our own integrity. It's called Panic, and this is a short summary of it. There was a row of dominoes standing equidistant in a long, narrow line that circled back into itself. Since the distance between them was shorter by half than their length, all knew that if one ever lost its balance, all would have trouble keeping theirs. Got that picture? The dominoes all lined up. Now and then something happened that made them shake, and some seemed more tipsy than others, but no force that touched them ever went beyond each other's ability to rebalance. And the dreaded unstoppable chain reaction, which each knew was they were powerless to reverse, never began. But one day, it happened. It was number 10101. Number 10101 teetered, shook, pivoted on its corner, righted itself, and then fell flat against its neighbor. Its neighbor, 10100, was taken so unawares that it immediately fell against its neighbor, and that sequence repeated itself at several hundred times before all the dominoes recognized that malignant state of their condition. As the process continued, some gave in without a fight. Others pretended it wasn't happening. A few became so anxious that they fell over before it was their time, so that here and there, the tipping was being replicated in more than one place along the line. As the wave persistently moved on, each domino mobilized all its energy to hold up or push back its falling neighbor. But it was to no avail. The continuing felling force was just too much for each individual domino's own weight and size. In addition, the very nature of their existence worked against them. To hold one neighbor up would have been difficult enough, but to fight the accumulating movement was out of the question. It was becoming increasingly hopeless to think that anything could arrest the course of these events before they reached their natural termination, when suddenly it all stopped. They stopped with such resounding force and suddenness that at first the cumulative energy redirected and created a backlash, and they started to fall the other way. A ricochet occurred that actually reversed the process, but lessening its destructive effects. Eventually, though, the energy being expended was just enough to push each in succession into an upright position without actually bowling over. It all happened so fast that before any of the dominoes had time to consider what had happened, all were basically standing up once again, nice and erect, quivering here and there, but basically stable. So what happened? One domino managed to not tip over. So all the other ones asked him, "How did you do it?" The domino answered, that domino who did not domino, "I'm not sure what the difference was. All I can say is that while each of you kept trying to hold up your neighbor, my concern was that I did not go down." So what's the moral of the story? put on your own oxygen mask first, right? Take care of yourself. Take care of your own groundedness and rootedness. And that's my one bit of advice in ministry and life when the anxiety threatens to overwhelm us and send us running or spinning in panic. I'm telling it to you here today because I need to hear it again myself. First, put on your own oxygen mask, and then take a good deep breath or three. Open your eyes and look around. When the panic threatens to overwhelm you, first take care of yourself enough to scale back your own anxiety just a notch or two. Simple things like breathing and going for a walk, or doing something playful, or nudging your family or your congregation towards play can help keep the panic at bay. Rather than seeking to numb or escape the discomfort of our anxiety, the best advice is to lean into it and ask questions, lots of them. Most importantly, we have to stay connected, to show up rather than run away. Staying as curious as you can, continuing to care, and at the same time, taking care of yourself. We talk about being non-anxious presence, but that's just not realistic. Nobody's a non-anxious presence, but we could be slightly less anxious presences. Slightly less anxious could actually end up being the help we all need to live together, to build community, to transform ourselves, and transform the world. So as we begin this co-ministry, Craig and I do indeed stand witness to the many resources you have within you for your own healing. This congregation has such great people and such depth of wisdom and strength of character. I know we will indeed find our way forward. And of course, we're not there yet. It's a process of growth and transformation that will take each of us our own lifetimes. So let's slow down the spinning and instead enjoy the journey. May it be so.
When I was 3 years old and my sister's age was still being measured in months, my father had an educators conference in Texas, and my parents decided to take the plunge and drive from St. Louis to Dallas. We loaded up the car with all of the baby implements plus our luggage and set off on the journey. First, however, we needed to fill up the car with gas. As we pulled into the local station, I piped up from the back, "Are we there yet?" At that point, my parents knew they were in big trouble. The online Urban Dictionary describes the phrase, "Are we there yet?" as, quote, "an incessant question used by passengers to incite the driver of a vehicle to distraction." Utterance of this query is said to result not only in the oft-heard, "Don't make me pull this car over," but also to result in, according to the dictionary, more accidents and divorces than cell phone and internet usage combined. When Reverend Virginia suggested the title for this morning's service, I don't think it was because anyone at UUCMC had uttered this dreaded question in the context of our newly launched experiment in co-ministry. After all, it was only 2 weeks ago that she passed around the microphone asking for you to come up with future indicators for how we might know that co-ministry will have been successful. We're not there yet, whatever and wherever there implies. But whatever the case, I find instructive the suggestion by Urban Dictionary that the only real defense against the aggravation induced by "are we there yet" belligerence, even when the destination is but 5 minutes away, the only real defense is the response, "It's at least another hour." It's at least another hour. So, sure, It's a way to get anxious questionings off your back. But at the heart of the Urban Dictionary's joking is an important reminder, I think. Giving oneself some extra time to breathe is almost always a good thing. There is wisdom in slowing down, taking stock, parsing out one's energy over a longer arc of possibilities. Had our frightened little bunny in the story Wisdom this morning taken the time to investigate the source of the noise that startled, giving themselves the dignity of trusting in their ability to assess the situation at hand, perhaps they wouldn't have succumbed so readily to the kind of worry that spread through the forest animal system like wildfire. It is in the context of this new journey of co-ministry that my reflections have been taking shape this month. 2 weeks ago, I argued that if walkers with dogs I find along the country roads by my house took the time to establish a mutually trained way of walking alongside one another rather than the dog pulling the human along behind it, the companionship at the heart of pet ownership could be more readily realized. I analogized it to the congregation moving together through space alongside its co-ministers with covenantal agreements on how to proceed, taking in the sights along the way. And I waxed on the beauty I notice when I walk the paths where I live rather than driving quickly by. So this week, the merits of consistency in moving slowly forward together rather than various dashings toward possible solutions were on my mind. Something akin to the idea of slow and steady winning the race. And Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare came to my mind. Interestingly, in the history of the fable's reception, the virtue of the tortoise's measured persistence wasn't initially the moral of the story, so much as the fable serving as a cautionary tale against the cockiness and pride of the hare. After mocking the tortoise for its plodding, the hare decides it can nap during the race and still win, only to find upon waking that it has slumbered too long and can no longer catch up to the tortoise, who doggedly has put 2 feet in front of the others in pursuit of the finish line. So a message not so much that quickness is a fault, but that careless alacrity can lead to folly. Moving forward unthinkingly without having a plan in hand is to be avoided. But also a moral that slow, intentional, consistent movement forward can be wise. Especially before I sing, often in the shower to take advantage of the steam, I do an exercise to expand my lung capacity and hone my breath release muscles. Singing, as many of you may know, is all about breath control, about knowing how much air one will need to complete a musical phrase or to hold a note a certain length of time. The thing is, as you hold a note, the air at your disposal is decreasing at the same time that the note you're holding is requiring more and more effort to sustain. So the machinery underlying the held note is a process that shifts as you go along. Slow breath release at first, and then once surely on the desired trajectory, increased breath along the way. You can try this exercise later, and I urge you to, but here it is. You begin by taking in a breath of air, and then the goal is to release all the air in your lungs at the same rate for the duration of the full exhalation. Now, you make an S noise to monitor the volume of air as you do this. Now, if you just blew out air, your S sound would start out strong and quickly peter out, something like, right? So in order to keep a consistency of sound, you have to plan your exhalation beginning by holding some air in reserve and gradually increasing the air release to maintain the same volume of sound. So here's what it sounds like when you do it right. Now, we don't usually completely exhale, leaving stale air in our lungs, which disallows full inhalation. So what happens in my exercise is that at the second inhalation, we can get in more air than the first intake. And so at each repetition of the exercise, up to about four rounds, I would suggest, you should be able to take deeper breaths and to hold the S sound slightly longer than the time before. So you not only hone your breath control muscles, but you open up your lungs, fully aerating your bloodstream's delivery to your cells, and your whole body is better for it. So I'm giving you a good tool for health and strength. Try it at home. But the real reason I'm sharing this vocal exercise for you this morning is that it can serve as a metaphor for congregational life, especially when you have a new minister in your midst, or as it happens, two co-ministers. Think of that mutual challenge and opportunity as a musical line. So let's plan our breath. We would do well to start by not rushing out of the gate. If we just blow air out quickly, over and over, we'll end up hyperventilating or getting dizzy, like when you blow up a balloon. So instead of rushing ahead, like the hare, overly confident in our air capacity over time, we would be advised to measure our air and steadily move forward through the exercise like the tortoise, perhaps slowly increasing the energy with which we release the air to maintain the quality and consistency of sound over time. On August 18th, I will report here back on some things I learned at General Assembly earlier this summer in Spokane, Washington. But if I could distill one current of thought that was present there down, it might be that if we are truly to be a we, W-E, that includes all people, we need to leave behind some of our falsely confident, perfectionistic ways, some of our rushing in to fix things quickly, some of our needing to feel competent and strong. Instead, we'd be advised to slow down and allow for fuller options to emerge in our processes. Solutions, ideas, plans that we may never have given the space to imagine in the past. Only then can we harness the power of we. That was the assembly's theme. Then, to the answer of, are we there yet? The answer would always be yes. For wherever we are, there we will be. And this morning I suggest that what goes for the denomination as a whole applies to us too, congregational family of Monmouth County. To extend my metaphors, if we take an ample breath, let it out with communal intention, building up strength as we go, consistent across the release, we may well find ourselves at the end of the note, or the phrase, or the race, or the congregational year, not hyperventilated, not panicked and trying to catch up, not full of dashed pride and defensive posturing, but safely arrived, calm, secure, and ready to take another breath, deeper and more sustainable than the last. This is my wish. May it be so. I invite us into a time of prayer and meditation. Beginning, we'll just remain seated